Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast, your co-host Scott Parkin in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko and Nozell. Before we get started, though, I want to thank you for making sure that we didn't have any hurricanes this year, for having the cleanest hurricane season we've had in a long time. And I know that you did that.
I want to thank you for saving hundreds of millions of lives by preventing the flow of cocaine into what apparently is 90% of the country is addicted to cocaine, which is news to me, but I guess that tracks. So,
well, the one person we know brought cocaine in was the president of Honduras, who Trump just pardoned. And I'm thinking that was probably Don Jr.'s personal supplier, right?
Yeah, exactly. Probably why he got the pardon.
400 tons on it. That tracks too, right?
I mean, apparently it was Roger Stone who delivered the letter to Trump about the pardon. So that's true. And so it all makes a lot of sense at this point.
But admit it, you have a tattoo of Nixon on your back too, because you're such a big fanboy of Roger Stone.
Exactly. Roger Stone. We should see if we can get Roger Stone on the podcast.
I bet he would. I think there's a chance. We should do that. We should. That would be awesome. I would like, that'd be a mic drop moment, man.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Anyway, recently we saw an obituary a couple of days ago and decided to just Was it just yesterday? Decided to put something together because we like to do history, and this is a theme that is unfortunately still really relevant today.
Yeah, and it was in the news, report in the New York Times yesterday, that Eugene Hassenfuss, who was the age of 45, he was a Marine, a Vietnam vet, he was a laid-off construction worker at the time. He had, in 1986, been shot down by the Sandinistas on a covert mission sponsored by who he at least thought was the CIA, where they were delivering arms to the Contras, right-wing rebels who were fighting the Sandinistas. They're the counter-revolutionaries after the Sandinistas took over in 1979. But Hassenfuss's, him getting shot down, actually led to a bigger sort of exposure of what turned out to be like a bigger scandal, which was what was known as the Iran-Contra affair. And so we're going to actually talk about Iran-Contra. We're going to talk about Reagan foreign policy and Reagan policy towards Central America. And as always, because we'll talk a little bit about how it's relevant to what's happening today.
Yeah. The main theme here is going to be Iran-Contra, and that goes back. We associate it with Reagan, as we should, but it actually goes back before that. The conditions that led to Iran-Contra began when Jimmy Carter was president. We've done a couple shows on Carter, who you couldn't admire him more for what he did after he was president, but as president, he's a war criminal. And in the late 70s, Carter did a couple things that would snowball and lead to something like Iran-Contra. On one hand, he began initially covert operations against a Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan. And he began to send money to groups that would later become the Mujahideen, and he'd have kind of a series of blowback there. And that's also conditioned by politics in the Middle East, Israel, Lebanon, and all that kind of stuff. We'll just talk about in a minute. Less known is that in Central America, there were a series of uprisings beginning in the 70s against these American-backed dictators in places like Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, and especially in Nicaragua. And in 1979, a group called the Sandinistas, the FSLN, you can kind of see the flag back there, named after Cesar Augusto Sandino, who was a national hero there, came to power July 19, 1979. It was, I would call it like a democratic socialist kind of government. And of course, the American political class and the media immediately raised the alarms. These are communists and they're puppets of Cuba and all that kind of thing. So Jimmy Carter, actually, just months after, even before the Sandinistas came to power, Carter sent his Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, to a meeting of the OAS, Organization of American States, to try to prevent the Sandinistas from coming from power. He wanted to create a regional force that would go in and take over Managua. It was okay with getting rid of Somoza, who is this really brutal, horrible dictator, famously FDR said, yeah, sure, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. I think that was about his father, but that's been attributed to a lot, but I always say it, it's about Somoza, right? So Carter tries to prevent the Sandinistas from coming in, and then just months later begins to send, to create a fund, and it's pretty nominal, it's $10, $12 million, not a ton of money, to groups inside Nicaragua who would oppose the Sandinistas and either prevent them from coming from power or make it more difficult or in a perfect world get rid of them. And this is the really the origin story of what would become the Contras, right? At the same time, after the 1978 Iranian Revolution, where the Shah was overthrown and Ayatollah Khomeini came in and creates the Islamic Republic, the United States had frozen all Iranian assets and put on an arms embargo against Iran. Iran was public enemy number one. And in fact, starting in 1980, the United States began funneling billions of dollars in aid and weapons to Iraq.
Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein to fight against Iran. And there were regional differences. There were local conditions as well.
And a very brutal war. Very brutal war.
Millions killed, right? And this is still, Jimmy Carter is still president. So with Carter as president, the United States has a frozen asset. It's frozen assets against Iran, has an arms embargo against Iran. It's fighting against these death squad governments in Latin America. Actually, toward that end, I think we just put up an old show we did about El Salvador.
Yeah, we just reposted a 2020 episode about repression at home and abroad. The at home part's about the assassination of Black Panther Fred Hampton. But the abroad part is about the rape and murder of four Mary Knowles sisters, Catholic missionaries, by a U.S.-backed Salvadoran National Guard, the death squad.
Yeah. And so that, and Carter, of course, is beginning in a nominal way, but nonetheless an important way, to create and fund the Contras. And then Ronald Reagan is elected in the fall of 1980, comes to office, essentially proclaiming a new Cold War. Not that the old Cold War ever ended, but there was allegedly this Vietnam syndrome. America was looking inward and not being in Latin America, obviously that never ended. And U.S. continued to support Israel. I think that idea that the Cold War had ended, that there was a Vietnam syndrome, was always overwrought anyway. But Reagan comes in and really has his eyes set on Latin America. And the rhetoric is insane, right? They're a grave threat. They're the greatest threat to in the modern world. And they portray the Sandinistas in this really incredible way. The Sandinistas had won like UN recognition for their literacy programs. They created a huge child immunization program, which, as we know, would not be allowed in the US today. Just basic social democratic ideas. Literacy program, which was like incredible, right? They tried to redistribute wealth to some degree. But once in power, and especially with this onslaught initially from Carter and then from Reagan, they began, not surprisingly, to look for allies. A little bit from the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union is already in decay by this time. But clearly they were supported by, obviously, probably even more. Cuba never sent troops or anything like that. And that was part of the rhetoric about it too. So the stage is set then, and the United States wants to get rid of the Sandinista government, right? And that ramps up significantly under Reagan. He tells his national security advisor, first national security advisor, Robert McFarlane, to do whatever you have to do to help these people, the anti-Sandinista groups, keep body and soul together. Around the same time this is happening, Reagan is also dealing with an attack on Marine barracks in Lebanon, with Israeli atrocities, with kidnappings of American assets. And this around the time he also invades Grenada too. So there's a lot going on, right? So Reagan has his mind set on that. And I think it's also important here that this is probably the last time the Democratic Party actually, I think, took a strong stand on anything. They were against this.
Right.
Clearly.
They passed the
Bowling Amendment. That, yeah, they actually passed laws like the Bowling Amendment, which is 1980. I think there were 82. Two or three different. 82.
The Democrats had a big win in 82 in midterm elections, and it was after the 82 elections.
Yeah. Now, public opinion polls were overwhelmingly against U.S. involvement in Latin America, in Central America. We're talking about Central America here more than Latin America in general. So they were like 2-1 against, which is really similar to what we're seeing now with Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing the public support for the war of Venezuela's with the Trump ride or die people. It's very small.
It's not even a majority of Republicans support that. And I think it's important to understand, like, Trump.
And members of the Republican Party are actually very outspoken in opposition to this. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Rand Paul, increasing other members of the House and Senate who have been running scared from Trump for quite some time now, smell blood in the water. Venezuela is one of the issues where they're making their stand.
I think, you know, we say this all the time, Trump is a different kind of cat, and just words fail, right? But this isn't unique. It really isn't. And Iran-Contra, I think, is a good example of that, right? So Reagan says, do whatever you have to do to keep these folks going, body and soul together, right? But the Bolin Amendment has prohibited aid to the Contras. Remember, what did Reagan call the Contras? Do you remember that?
The moral equivalent of the Founding Fathers.
The moral equivalent of the Founding Fathers, which actually has some truth to it, but that's not what he meant, right?
Despite what Ken Burns tells us, right?
Oh my God, that's what I heard last week. Have you seen the Ken Burns show? Yeah, I don't know anything about that. What do I know? Anyway, neither here nor there. Now, at the same time this is happening, so Reagan is trying to figure out ways to help these anti-government forces, these counter-revolutionaries who became known, contra-revolutionaries, as Contras, not surprisingly. At the same time, and there are two things going on here, which are very important because they'll morph together. Iran-backed militias, referred to obviously as terrorists, who were fighting a war against Iraq, which was being funded and supported by the United States, were seizing hostages in the region and staging attacks to respond to America's support of Iraq and guess what other country in the Middle East?
Israel?
Shock. That's a hell of a guess, man. Who knew?
Shock.
Know, right? So they decide to put it together. And I believe McFarland came up with the original idea of selling arms to Iran, which violated a million different laws, right? Iran is the international pariah. You have frozen assets, you have arms embargoes, right? So McFarland says, we can sell arms to Iran. At the same time, the United States is providing arms to Iraq to fight against Iran. When I used to teach and I would tell this, and my students would be like, mouths, oh my God, really? It was a great story, right? So McFarland said, let's sell arms to Iran. And then we can take that money and we can give it to the Contras because the Bolin Amendment has told us we're not allowed to do that. And so the United States sold, the numbers vary, but I think it was somewhere in the area of around 1,500 missiles. And in return, they got 3 hostages released, which for those hostages is great. McFarland was replaced by somebody named Admiral, was it John Poindexter?
Yeah, John Poindexter.
Now, Poindexter is the guy who brings in another one of the heroes of this, or anti-heroes of this entire episode. Poindexter has an aide named Oliver North.
Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North.
Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North is, if he wasn't such a scurrilous, horrible person, he's really a pretty good story. Pretty quite a character, isn't he?
Yeah. It's quite, he has quite the interesting background too.
Yeah. He's the modern version of Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy and those people.
That's exactly how he saw himself too. In Vietnam vet, he was in a boxing match with James Webb at the Naval Academy.
Famous book on that.
Nightingale's Song.
North is a true believer, hardcore. Didn't he also write like episodes of The Americans, that show about the Russian spies?
In the 2010s, yeah.
Yeah.
Or he consulted with them so much, they gave him a writing credit, I think.
Is that it? Okay.
And he also recently got married.
Too. Well, let's not spoil the lead.
Yeah. Okay.
So Poindexter brings in Oliver North. Oliver Stone, that it's still out there, $200 cash money. I'm willing to go $500 if you want to drive a hard bargain. Come on and debate me.
$500. You heard it here.
Cash money.
Yeah.
Cash money. Anyway, he brings Oliver North in to coordinate this mission and arrange the sales. And this is all being done behind the scenes. I don't think, and this is it. Reagan was reelected in 1984 overwhelmingly, but you can see, like, personally, he's fading. The signs are there that he's addled and has something going on.
That sounds like strikingly familiar to today as well. But
Sleepy Joe, you mean? Because
or the commander at sleep?
Dude, he just had a perfect MRI. His physician said he's never seen anything.
I think he's had 5 perfect MRIs in the last 4 months, right?
Well, who doesn't have an MRI every few weeks?
I mean, annual, he has his annual physical every couple of months too, right? Is that right?
That doesn't mean he's sick. I think the doctors are mesmerized by what an amazing physical specimen he is, and they just want to, for their own sake.
I love the, just a quick tangent. I love the video of Marco Rubio sitting there going off about, you know, what a great president he is. And then Trump is just like nodding off.
Yeah. Marco also decided to take this important meeting and use it to talk about the college football playoffs and how the University of Miami should be in there. And these guys are on top of it. At any rate, Reagan is starting to fade and he's not nearly as popular as he was. And actually, by the time he's out of office, Reagan's numbers are way down. He doesn't have the same kind of cachet he had early on. But this is all still being done surreptitiously and on the sly. The United States continues to send huge amounts of money and weapons to Iraq in a very brutal and bloody war, which I think kills well over 1 million Iranians. Reagan approves the use of chemical and biological weapons in Iran against the Iranians. So when they talked about WMDs decades later, that's true. There were WMDs in Iraq. The United States provided them to use against Iran with American advisors in the field.
Right. And a big green light. But they also used them against the Kurds, the Iraqi Kurds as
yes.
well.
That goes back to, we're all over the place here, but that's fine because everything is connected. This is how I teach history, by the way. It's been one of my classes. I love going all around the place and connecting all together. But in 1975, Kissinger began a covert program to help the Kurds fight against, you know, the government, Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party. And it really wasn't going well. So Kissinger, without warning, just withdrew aid from the Kurds, just pulled the rug out from under them. And Saddam went in and gassed 20,000, I forget the name of the village. I think that was part of the indictment when they finally captured him and executed him. And somebody asked Kissinger, wow, you gave aid to these people and you gave them hope and then you just withdrew it and they all got massacred. And Kissinger's famous response is covert operations is not missionary work. So anyway, and I think that's probably, that should be like an American mantra. That's clearly, that's never changed. At any rate, though, getting back. So that's going on. The United States is funding Iraq to fight against Iran, but it's also selling weapons through the back door to Iran, which is going to use to fight against the American-backed army of Iraq. So the United States is, which is nothing new, right? About 10, 15 years ago in Syria, the United States, the CIA had a militia that it was funding and arming, fighting against a Pentagon militia in Syria. They were fighting against each other.
And at least one of those was an Al-Qaeda faction.
I think so.
I think
it's Al-Qaeda.
Unless they become president of Syria.
Unless they become But the U.S. hates Muslims. Now, is Jelani included in the Muslim ban?
I don't know. It's Mohammed bin Salman.
Bin Salman. Hey, mistakes get happen. Things happen. And you don't know how bad Khashoggi was.
Exactly.
It's crazy. Anyway, so Oliver Stone is now arranging this, right?
Oliver North is arranging this. Oliver Stone made a movie also in that period.
Oh, you don't know about the deep state conspiracy, do you?
Yeah, that's
true. It was Oliver Stone.
That's true.
We should start that. You know damn well with the month, there'd be a lot of people buying into it.
Yeah. He made a movie about Central America starring James Woods, who's definitely all in that crowd now, too.
Yeah. Didn't like the movie. It was weird. But at any rate.
No.
Oliver Stone, another tangent, like he's clearly critical of the United States. But all these movies have this moment of American exceptionalism. Like in that movie, is it Woods who said, or was it Belushi who says, this isn't what Americans do. We're going to tell the press about all this and you're going to all go to jail.
Right.
And then in Platoon, the Willem Dafoe character, Dafoe is okay with the war. He just doesn't want it fought the wrong way with all these atrocities and stuff like that. So Oliver Stone really does have this kind of stars and stripes approach.
You mean he's a liberal? Really? What a shock. JFK is just, and the American exceptionalism is truly comes out in JFK, which I don't think you've seen.
No, I've seen it long ago.
But I mean, it's the ultimate American exceptionalism sort of film. The whole, that's the theme of the film. Well,
That's the whole point. Kennedy's, and Stone believes in heroes and heroism. I mean, that's kind of what we have here. Oliver Stone, I think, is a great, Oliver North is a good example of that. So all this is going on. It's very complex. It's pretty Byzantine. I'm doing a very superficial description of it. Is there anything like, because we're getting to the kind of Hasenfuss part of things, right?
I think that this sort of background and connecting the dots, which is what they did, right? It's like they were doing back channel deals with the Iranians, which actually they did in 1980 around the election as well.
Yep. October surprise, sure.
So they're making back end deals with the Iranians, who they at least publicly denounce as a terror state. They're feeding them missiles while they're funding the Iraqi war effort. They're trying to get hostages released in Beirut. And then they've created this slush fund so they can get around the Boland Amendment to fund this illegal war against the Sandinistas. And honestly, the other important thing to really note here is that we're talking about the Contra War with the Sandinistas, but like during this period, during the 1980s, there's civil war in a number of these Central American countries. And so there's like very brutal, bloody civil war going on in El Salvador, which costs at least tens of thousands of lives. I don't remember the exact numbers.
About 80,000 killed by the U.S.-backed governments and militias.
Right. In Guatemala, which I think even has a higher casualty rate.
Guatemala is a genocide, and they particularly go after, obviously, anti-government forces.
Coca-Cola has
bottling plants in a lot of these countries where people talk about unionization and death squads come out and kill. And that's a piece of this that's really not mentioned, but I think people understand it. This is a brutal, bloody war, which is consistent. Like the kind of stuff you're seeing in Israel today, that's happening there.
And
Contras.
The one other thing I want to say is that this death squad model, which you can track back to Vietnam around the Phoenix program. We just talked about this in our show on Trump versus Kelly.
Hey, Biggs.
But the Central America model is what they used in Iraq and Afghanistan
in
the 2000s and 2010s. It's a anti-population counterinsurgency model where they just like wage war on the population, whether they're armed,
kind of Kennedy armed or not. Yeah, Kennedy internal security, which is why, and I'm not like, I think Vincent Babbins has written a really good book, but I think a lot of people have taken this to Jakarta method. They do that. That existed before Jakarta. That's consistent with just Cold War foreign policy. But the Contras, I think, and you have to keep this, and we did know about this because the media, this is probably the last time the media actually did a really good job of covering stuff like this as well. But the CIA was training the Contras in Honduras, especially a U.S. senator at the time, Jim Sasser, a Democrat from Tennessee, imagine that, called Honduras the USS Honduras. Like basically the U.S. owned the country. They were training death squads there. The U.S. mined Nicaraguan harbors. The U.S. was found in violation of international law by various international courts. And guess what Reagan did?
He just kept doing it.
He kept, right? So Biden and Trump rejecting international law, again, is nothing new, right?
There's one other thing I want to mention around this death squad piece, which is that there's actually a school at Fort Benning, Georgia, which I think is called the Western Hemispheric Institute for Security, but it's more notoriously known as the School of Americas, which is actually where a lot of these officers who were in these Latin American death squads, they were the Salvadoran National Guard, or they were in the Honduran Army, or lots of stuff in South America as well. And so that's actually a piece here too. There was a pretty big movement against School of the Americas coming out of the Central America Solidarity Movement, which still continues today, but there was a heyday of the school. It was called School of the Americas Watch, which was the sort of organizing body. But it was like a very important piece here too, is that they're being backed and funded by the CIA, but they're also being trained by the U.S. military in torture and counterinsurgency and assassination, all of that in Fort Benning, Georgia.
Yeah, there was a point at which I think every American aligned government in the entire region was led by a graduate of School of the Assassins, is also called. And we're going to talk about that. That's also that movement against Central America. It's also important because it's a really great example of the government surveillance, right? Kind of stuff we saw earlier in COINTELPRO and that we're seeing today, like with college campuses and all this stuff. These groups, especially there were a lot of them, were Catholic worker associated groups, Catholic pacifist groups. There were groups called the Committee in Solidarity with El Salvador, CISPAS. There was CISQUA, there was various Nicaraguan. This is
It's a sanctuary movement. There's a sanctuary movement.
Parenthetically, this is where I got my political education. I was a New Deal liberal, labor liberal, and it was Central America that really flipped me because I was living in D.C. at the time and just like reading, and I got to know a bunch of people, both in grad school and in the activist community who were doing stuff on this. And the Sandinistas were like this really cool, like I said, social democratic revolution. And to see the vigor force that the U.S. used against them really was an incredible practical education in empire and imperialism, the Cold War and American foreign policy. I think it was on Fridays we would go down. Contra headquarters was on, I think maybe Wisconsin Avenue. I don't remember. But on Friday, we would go down there like every Friday to protest. When they would let us like on the sidewalk and stuff like that. We actually saw the mention of Oliver Stone and Fawn Hall go in.
Oliver North.
Shit, now I'll never get that. But it became a big issue. And this is just like what we knew. But all hell broke loose around 1986, right? It starts with, I believe, Cy Hirsch again, the famous Cy Hirsch, friend of the podcast, right? Who, speaking to sources in the Pentagon, who obviously were anonymous, who were really deeply troubled by what was going on, told North about this connection between Iran and the Contras, right? It was initially actually reported by a newspaper in Lebanon, which was dismissed as a rag and you can't trust Lebanese media and stuff like that. But it slowly starts to get talked about. I remember at the time reading the U.S. press, the U.S. left press, things like Mother Jones and The Nation, which at the time had people like Andrew Coburn and Andrew Kopke. The Nation was like outstanding back then. Today, whatever. But so that was hinted at in left media, but not really picked up. But then getting to the, we talk about bearing the lead, right? And also, I think that the one thing too is because we just did a show on this the other day about Mark Kelly and others. People in the Pentagon talk to people on the outside, and they're the ones who started to express concern over what was going on, both from a policy point of view. I told you before, like I spent a lot of time back then doing my research at the Washington Navy Yard, and I met a lot of folks. And these are like colonels, a couple generals even, who said, we don't want any part of Central America. It's a bad idea. We don't belong there. And so they leaked that out. But I think the bigger part where it really blows up is with the aforementioned Eugene Hassafus. And when that was in.
And that's what sort of blows. I remember I believe I was a senior in high school in 1986 when Hassafus got shot down. And then all of a sudden, people in Congress, people in the media start asking, why was this guy doing? What were the three other people on the plane died? Hassafus was an experienced skydiver, the only person who brought parachute onto the plane, and that's how he was able to get away. He had done jump school when he was in the Marines. But it opens up this whole inquiry, which we see less of today in our these institutions, which we think are what where public accountability should happen, like the media and Congress and things like that. But it eventually just it completely blows up. It's on the front page of every newspaper. It's like, how much did Reagan know? When did he know it? There was a lot of reference. I believe at one point they were calling Iran-Contra Gate because there's a lot of reference
Contra Gate
to water.
Was the first use of it.
Yeah.
He was also, I think, it wasn't the plane. It was a civil, what was it called? Civil Airlines, or Civil Air Transport.
Yeah.
That's a CIA front. That was it, right?
It's called Southern Transport Airlines or something.
Right, but I believe, wasn't it associated with CAT, I think?
Yes. And it was a bunch of ex-Air America people, too, who did.
Yeah, that was originally, after World War II, it was founded by Claire Chennault, who was a general, an Air Force general. They were very active in the cocaine, and I'm sorry, in the drug trade, the opium trade in Southeast Asia during Vietnam. In Vietnam, it was Air America, right? It becomes Civil Air Transport. I think people don't, and that'd be cool to try to bring on somebody like maybe William Hartung or somebody to talk about this, right? The CIA owns a bunch of private companies. Front companies and civil air transport was a man. That was what Hassafus was flying, wasn't it? And this also led to another piece of this, which we haven't mentioned yet, which is the Contra cocaine connection. A bunch of investigative journalists began to make these connections. And essentially, they claimed that not just was the United States sending weapons to Iran to get money to give to the Contras, but the United States was actually transshipping cocaine to raise money for the Contras because of the Boland Amendment.
And the most noted journalist is a guy named Gary Webb, who worked for the newspaper in San Jose. And in the mid-90s, actually, committed suicide or is said they committed suicide. There's a lot of conspiracy theories around it. But he had been finding evidence that the CIA had actually been bringing, had been helping transport cocaine into southern, at least Southern California, into the Los Angeles area.
Which fuels the crack
epidemic as well. And that the money was going to support the Contras who were fighting the Sandinistas.
And
Dennis Bernstein, actually.
And Robert Perry.
Yeah, did a lot of investigation on this as well. And
we should try to get Dennis on to talk about this.
Dennis is a good friend of the podcast. So that's another
person on Pacifica I'll talk to.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have this Contra cocaine connection. This guy's flying a CIA airline on a CIA associated affiliate airline. He's captured by the Sandinistas. They convicted him and he was back home within 30 days, right? But then that's really when the shit finally starts to hit the fan. And Hirsch has these Pentagon leaks. Now you have Haas and Fuss. And this is when the kind of cover up flies into action. This is when we learn about Oliver North and Fawn Hall. It comes out that they were shredding documents. Imagine that. Fawn Hall was hiding documents in her boots. And I wonder if one of those days, because she always had on boots, right? I wonder if one of those days I saw her, she had documents hidden in her blouse or something like that, right? And they shredded documents. They're part of this cover up. And everyone finally discovered that this Lebanese newspaper, which broke the story, actually was right. They had the story right. That the United States was taking money from illegal sales of arms to Iran and then using it to fund the Contras. The cocaine piece of it never really got far in mainstream stuff, right? And then the investigations began. I think the original one was by John Tower, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Tower Commission, I believe. And Muskie, maybe?
Yeah. I'm trying to, I don't think it was Muskie, it was someone else, but it was John Tower and a Democrat who were investigating this. So it starts as a congressional investigation, but then also there's also an independent counsel, the dreaded independent counsel, which is appointed for this, which is now Trump's just pretty much abolished independent counsels unless it's investigating his enemies. But Lawrence Walsh becomes the independent counsel who begins to investigate this, which actually leads to something 14 convictions of Reagan officials and associates. 14.
Before that, because I'd written about this some time ago and I found it. When the investigation was taking place, Edwin Meade, now apparently Schultz and Weinberger opposed this from the start. The Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State opposed this from the start, right? They said, this is messy. It's not going to work. But Meese discovered that a lot of that money that Iran paid for the missiles was missing, right? So it just went missing. So who knows, right? North said that the diversion of funds had been done under the direction of Poindexter, and he assumed the president, right? So they actually do create a link all the way to the top. Yesterday, the Pentagon spokesperson, I forget her name, with regard
Wilson,
to this Venezuela.
Wilson.
Yeah, with the double tap, right? She said, we take all our orders from the president and we follow the chain of command. So she threw Hegseth and Trump under the bus too, which is what North had done, right? He basically said, yeah, this goes to the top, right? And Reagan finally in 1987 speaks to the public. He said, I was misled. Mistakes were made. Doesn't really take responsibility for any of this, right? I did not trade arms for hostages. I believe that to be true in my heart. Maybe I was wrong, that kind of thing. Lawrence Walsh investigated. You're right, 14 members of Reagan's administration were charged. Poindexter, North, McFarlane were all convicted. North and Poindexter's convictions were overturned. Bush Sr., who became president after Reagan, pardoned McFarlane and a bunch of others, including Caspar Weinberger, before his trial. I think it's also important to understand that these hearings, there were public hearings on this, the Iran-Contra Committee, really set the model, because this is the first major scandal after Watergate. And I would actually argue it's worse than Watergate, right? And these are televised. And on the very first day, the Democrats decide to go for the kill. And Oliver North just manipulated them. North, very much like what we're seeing today, doubled down on what he did. He wasn't apologetic. He was apoplectic. He was defensive about what he did. I'm not defensive in the sense that, like, he was apologizing for defensively, he was defending it, right? Claiming that the Democrats were too weak, communism was bad, and the United States had to do something. They had to take this into their own hands, right? And he absolutely manipulated and controlled those hearings, and they were really a disaster for the Democratic Party. And it really set this tone, right, on how the Democrats really are incapable of going to war against the Republicans, talking about the Iran-Contra hearings, right, the publicized hearings, where North just dominated it, right? The Democrats, he just put them in their place, and he became this national hero after this, right? So instead of becoming like the fall guy for it, he became a national hero. He actually used it to run and almost win a Senate seat in Virginia.
In 94, against the Chuck Robb.
Chuck Robb still. This is also important because what we're seeing today from these like weaklings and these people like Schumer and Jeffries and Merrick Garland and all that, this is what the Democrats did in the 80s. And again, they had public opinion on their side. The American people had overwhelmingly turned against this scheme, right? Now, in Nicaragua, it actually worked. It served its purpose. The Sandinistas in 1984 held an election, which they won. The United States refused to accept the results of that election. And international observers all said that it was on the up and up. And the U.S. continued and increased its pressure, right? By the later 80s, the Nicaraguan economy was in trouble. It was screaming. The Contra attacks had continued. People were getting killed. The Pope at the time went after the Catholic Church. A lot of Nicaraguan Catholics had been instrumental in the Sandinista revolution. The foreign minister was Miguel Descoto. The minister of culture was famous. Oh my God, poet. I got to look it up. I have it on the wall here somewhere. Ernesto Cardenal. I forgot about him. So the Pope intervened. The Vatican intervened. And so by 1990, the Nicaraguan people were beaten down and actually voted the Sandinistas out, right? And what did those brutal, horrible communist terrorists do when they lost that election?
They gave up power.
They left.
Peaceful, right? Transition of power.
Peaceful transition. Hassenfuss, he's got a little footnote in history, but not an unimportant one. Because of him, more than anything else, this became a more public and national issue. It led to, not in a direct way, but it led
even
to,
in a way of an international issue as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It led to government hearings. It led to the Tower Commission. It led to Lawrence Walsh. It led to indictments. It led to convictions. It led to pardons. But I think a couple of the other lasting impact of this, which we're seeing today, is pressure from the empire succeeds. We love to talk about resistance, right? We're caught up in this, like, people's history. The people fought back. The people resisted. The people did this. The people, that, you know, people often generally get crushed at the end, too. I mean, that's what happened in Nicaragua, as well as in El Salvador, to some degree. They did have changes. And Guatemala was a genocide, right? But the United States had its fingerprints over all of that. And they really destroyed the Sandinista revolution, right? Which is why, like, when you see what's happening today in Venezuela, this is an old story. It's an old playbook, right? One reason, like, Cuba's no threat to the United States. I guess they would like to have access to its agriculture and whatever, cigars. And I'm sure Trump wants to put a casino on the Malecón. But the biggest problem with Cuba is it never surrendered. It's still there.
Noam Chomsky called the threat of a good example.
The threat of a good example. Kennedy, JFK, actually, that was his formulation, right? And that's, Cuba is a living symbol, despite the most brutal, horrific embargo in the history of the world, right? And so when you see what Israel is doing today, or when you see what Trump is doing, or what's happening in Ukraine, or Sudan, or Syria, or a million other places, it's an old story. It's an old playbook, right?
And yeah.
Contra is a really great example of that.
Yeah. I think that's like an important thing to note, which is part of a big theme of this podcast is obviously history and people's history. And so I think it's important to note that the murder of the nuns in El Salvador, Iran-Contra, is all still very much the same playbook that's being used today against Venezuela and increasingly Colombia. And I don't think we're the kind of folks who think that learn your history so you don't repeat it. We're not really those guys. But I think it is important to note that this is like repeats, this is repeating itself. And this is to be aware of, this is an important thing.
Yeah. Another coda to this, there are many, but the government that led Nicaragua at that time was led by Daniel Ortega, who is currently president of Nicaragua again.
He's co-president, right?
Is he?
But yeah, I think
not, so. Yeah, you know, let's face it. It's not your father's Sandinista party. Yeah. There's a lot going on there that I don't think was consistent with the ideals of the 1980s and 1990s. And having your government become the object of the biggest empire in the world. And the rhetoric at the time, Pat Buchanan said that, what was it, the Sandinistas are as close to, was it Harlingen, Texas, or there, Harlingen, Texas is at risk, right?
Yeah.
Or it was just like this incredible rhetoric about this. The Sandinista army at the time, the Nicaraguan army, could not have defeated like a major city police force. They didn't have the same weaponry as like the Houston police or the LA police or something
right.
like
that. Yeah.
But the rhetoric was incredible, the fear. I'm not sure people bought it. I think another coda is that this is actually the last time the Democrats, I think, put up any kind of a real fight over issues like this.
Right.
It also showed that the United States could just flagrantly ignore international laws and get away with it. Inside the United States, government officials could break the law and it wouldn't be a problem. Even if they were convicted, they would be pardoned, which we're seeing time and again today.
Yeah, I think the pardon piece is really important because liberals get very outraged by Trump's pardon and pardon wave of pardons that he does, whatever you want to call it. And granted, it is very disturbing. And I'm sure there are pardons already written for people like Christine Noem and Pete Hegseth and things like that. But Bush pardoned a number of people who were Iran-Contra players when he was leaving office at the end of 1992, like people who had been
Weinberger
convicted.
As good as it gets.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And so I just want to note that that also is not an atypical thing. That's not unique to this period of history that we're in right now. Trump pardons a lot of people. He just pardoned the former president of Honduras, who was a cocaine trafficker, which is like pretty bad, but still, you know, this the precedent that is set here. About a month ago when Dick Cheney died, we talked about how he cleared the way and set precedent for Trump to be able to do a lot of what he did. But it goes back before Cheney as well.
Trump is a different kind of a cat and doing horrific things on steroids. But it's this old way of doing things, but it's on steroids. It's horrific. Like a lot of lefties want to say, oh, everybody's been doing that. And Trump is different. And yeah, he is a different kind of threat. Even with Nixon and Reagan and anybody, really, you didn't fear like your own survival was threatened, maybe with a nuclear war. Whereas with Trump, there are people like driving in the streets, snatching folks away, which again, that's not, it's never happened on this scale. So we're in a different world. But clearly the skids were greased by things like Iran-Contra. I remember when it happened thinking, and Nixon was still alive at the time. I was thinking like, Nixon must be like beside himself. I got in trouble for what I did and they're getting away with this. Yeah. And we just see more and more of that all the time now. There are no guardrails. There is no limit. There's no depth. And Pasenfuss's death, like, it'd be fun to talk about this because I think it's timely. It's relevant.
I'm sure Trump will give him some posthumous Medal of Freedom or something like
that. My last thing is the best media account of this, and sincerely, I'm not joking now, in the 1980s was an episode of Miami Vice starring G. Gordon Liddy as, what was it, Colonel Landslide?
Captain Real Estate.
And Crockett, who's a Vietnam vet, and his friend, played by Bob Balaban, who's a journalist, uncover these American death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador, and they're going to break the story. And G. Gordon Liddy, of course, kills it. He takes care of it. And I was stunned. I remember watching it at the time, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, nobody was doing that, but Miami Vice did. Miami Vice is one of the most underrated like political shows I've ever seen. I'm a big fan. But at any rate, and it was part of popular culture, especially on the left. And I will say for a lot of people, a lot of us like me, it became our training ground. These were our training wheels for political activism. I remember having a bumper sticker at the time that said El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. So it became very important to us.
I'll say that there was a recent show on FX called Snowfall, which actually dealt with the CIA cocaine story too, which was pretty, which is, I actually had somewhat lefty politics. It's about how the CIA is flooding cocaine into the black community and lefty journalists are killed. Yeah. And it's an interesting show. I think you're right, though. I think it's the Captain Real Estate episode of Miami Vice is the sort of classic,
crazy,
know, yeah, template for it. But like that's what that show is all about as well.
I would also recommend, I think I said this in the last show, right? Because we were talking about the pardons. Al McCoy's The Politics of Heroin. It was initially called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. He expanded it. It's just called The Politics of Heroin, which shows how, like in Vietnam, the Nguyen Van Thieu and Cao Ky were involved in the opium trade. And the United States knew it. So the U.S. doesn't have that kind of leverage over these folks that you would say.
You know, that's the story of the D.C. shooter, too, right? Is that he was part
of
a paramilitary.
That's what I brought up, right, yeah, right. Yeah. Because
and that counts.
Opium production in Afghanistan just increased wildly.
Yeah, we should probably wrap it. It's been rest good fun.
Peace, Eugene, I never thought I'd say that. Rest in peace, Eugene Astor.
Yeah, you changed the world in some ways you didn't expect. Yeah. Folks, you're listening to the Green and Red podcast. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're watching this on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. And then if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button to become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And it's getting to be the end of the year, so we're going to be doing a whole lot more fundraising and swag pushing and things like that. So if you want a hat or if you want a book, we'll be putting out stuff soon to give you that opportunity. Probably also, we also need to get the prison solidarity calendars going as well. But
we know the economy's bad, although Trump says inflation is lower than ever, so maybe it's not. But in any way,
affordability is just a scam. That's all.
You can do a Patreon for $3 a month. You can send a one-time donation of any amount, whether it folds or jingles, take it.
Yep. Yesterday was Giving Tuesday. We actually had a number of people give us money. Appreciate all those folks who gave us money.
We don't have much overhead, and this is not obviously a high-cost enterprise. We do most of this ourselves. But we do have some folks helping us that we'd like to give them a living wage, and which is fine. So if you can find it in your heart to do that for a really cool little lefty, we call ourselves a boutique lefty podcast. We're not big, we're not Brooklyn, but we do a lot of shit that you're not going to find anywhere else. And I'm showing my arrogance here, but I don't think anybody does better history stuff than we do.
100%.
If you want to help out.
Yep. Folks, we will talk to you again soon. So make trouble and misbehave, and we'll see you later.